From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Call me Ishmael. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long, I thought that I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. Ishmael. Whenever I grow grim about the mouth.
Ah! That is a mashup called Orson Welles, featuring Orson Welles reading from Herman Melville's great American novel Moby Dick, combined with a Led Zeppelin instrumental, Moby Dick. Today we'll look at mashups and the question of when it's appropriate to appropriate. A theater director tells us how he remixed Melville's Moby Dick. We'll also learn how music and technology have combined to create a new cultural moment. And Stephen Johnson will share his ideas on where good ideas come from, as we try to answer the question, is there such a thing as true original creativity? But first, Lewis Hyde. Hyde is a MacArthur Fellow, a creative writing professor, and the author of the modern classic, The Gift. His new book is called Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. It offers a defense of our cultural commons, the vast store of art and ideas we've inherited from the past and which continue to enrich our present. As he told Steve Paulson, Hyde is skeptical of the entertainment industry's argument that intellectual property is no different from physical property.
Well, it's false. The typical analogy they offer is that stealing a song on the internet is the same as stealing shoes from a shoe store or a physical book from a bookstore. The problem is that this erases one of the very important distinctions that we've been wrestling with for thousands of years, and particularly for the last 300 years, which is that art and ideas that are not embodied, that is a song, a mythology, the idea about how to make bifocal glasses, the Pythagorean theorem, Shakespeare's play, all these things are what economists call non-rival. That is to say, if you have them and I have them and somebody else wants them, we can give them to the third person without anybody losing anything. Famous line of Thomas Jefferson's. He says, ideas are like the fire of a flame, that if you light your candle from mine, it doesn't put my candle out. It just spreads the flame. So there's an important distinction between things that we do own but nonetheless have no physical presence and things we own which do have a physical presence. And part of the problem for the last 300 years has been to figure out how then to think about these incorporeal things like a novel, a poem, a song, and how to organize and imagine the ownership of them.
Are you saying we just need to throw out the whole idea of intellectual property?
No, I think it's a useful idea. Well, what we do now is have a regime called copyright and one called patent, which allows people to own created things. And I think these are useful tools. But one needs to understand that these are tools actually designed to deal with the fact that art and ideas are different in kind from shoes and physical books. And secondly, to come to a second distinction, once we're in this realm of things that happen in the mind, we're also in the realm of expression. So to give somebody ownership rights in that realm can also be thought of as giving them the right to suppress expression, to control art and ideas. And now we begin to think, well, maybe there's some reasons to limit people's ability to express, to suppress what other people want to express.
Now, another point that the entertainment industry has tried to put forward is that copyright infringement is the same as plagiarism. Again, you don't agree with that.
Well, they aren't the same. And I mean, what's puzzling is why their curricula simplify and, in a sense, stupefy these useful distinctions. Plagiarism means using somebody's work without acknowledging that it belongs to somebody else. You can plagiarize from Shakespeare, and there's no copyright infringement because copyright doesn't exist in Shakespeare's work. Similarly, you can infringe a copyright without plagiarizing. Copyright infringement is against the law. It's about legal rules. Plagiarism is typically an ethical violation in certain communities, but actually not in all communities. There are some, and in the book I talk, for example, about the community of law, where lawyers and judges regularly take from each other's work without attribution because the law is considered to be public discourse. Nobody owns it. And therefore, the rules of borrowing are different in legal discourse than they are, for example, in the academy. So plagiarism is, in some communities, an ethical violation. Copyright infringement is a matter of law.
Now, I think the way this would usually be thought of, let's take Shakespeare as an example. You quote some lines from Shakespeare to make a point, or you to incorporate into your own artistic work, and the reference to Shakespeare is clear. You know, it's not as if you're really ripping him off, but you're using him for your own artistic efforts, and that is quite different than lifting passages of a book that maybe no one knows about and then trying to pass it off as your own.
Right. That would be plagiarism. You know, all creativity builds on the world around it and what has come before. Everybody understands this in all realms, in science, in literature, in painting. You know, one knows what has happened in the past, and it's in your mind. Famously, Sir Isaac Newton said that he had stood on the shoulders of giants. Perhaps he had seen further, but he couldn't have seen as far as he did if there hadn't been scientists who came before him. So this business of borrowing is part of the creative process, no matter what world you're in.
And you devote a whole chapter in your book to Benjamin Franklin, which is interesting because the common thinking is that Franklin was the quintessential self-made man, this guy who went off and sort of dreamed up all these amazing inventions on his own. But you're saying the real story is more complicated.
Well, Franklin is a wonderful character, and he is, of course, was a genius, and few people are like him. But when you look closely at the way Franklin worked, you see that partly his genius was what I think of as the genius of a host, in the sense that he worked collaboratively with many other people, and also he read incredibly widely. So that, for example, Franklin is credited with some important discoveries in the theory of how electricity works. If you understand how Franklin came to them, you see that what he was doing was reading books that came out of England and France and Germany, corresponding with people on the continent, working with three friends in Philadelphia. He was working in a community, and he understood that he was working in a community and that he had obligations to that community too. So Franklin never took a patent on any of his inventions and said he intentionally did not do so because he felt indebted to the past. And he never took a copyright on any of his writings. The main point being that he felt that if you want to have a creative community, such as he had in the scientific world, you need low barriers to the circulation of knowledge.
Well, not only did he not claim legal ownership of some of his inventions, he didn't even publicize this, I mean, which is striking because he was a publisher himself. I mean, he did not – I mean, for instance, in Poor Richard's Almanac, he published instructions on how to make a lightning rod, but he didn't mention that he was the inventor.
Yeah, you know, one interesting thing is at this period we have a shift out of what's called guild secrecy into public knowledge. And so for centuries, guilds, you know, people who knew, for example, how to make swords out of steel would keep secret their knowledge. And what happens in the 18th century is people begin to think, no, it's much better to have knowledge released to the world. And Franklin is right on the cusp of this. And in fact, part of the structure of our patent law, even now, is you get to have your monopoly privilege for a short time in exchange for explaining to the whole world how you did it clearly enough that anybody else could do it as soon as it's released to the public domain. And so Franklin actually follows this without even taking a patent. That is to say, when he invents the lightning rod, he immediately publishes a full description of how to do it in Poor Richard's Almanac, doesn't sign his name. I mean, people would have assumed that it was Franklin, but the point for him was to disseminate knowledge, not to own it.
But you can't really imagine that happening today, can you? Let me push you on this a little bit, because it sounds like you're suggesting that if we lose our sense of a cultural commons, then we slip into tyranny on the artistic front. We lose our creativity because we're not allowed to borrow from cultural products that came before us. How far are you willing to go here?
I believe both those things are true, maybe in simpler senses than the words immediately call up. In the book, I borrow a thing from Pascal, who has an interesting definition of tyranny. He says, you know, the world is a complicated place. We have different realms of social practice and different norms in different realms. For example, the church is one world and your family is one and the marketplace is one and the army is one, colleges are one and so forth. And rightly so, these different worlds might have different norms about how to behave. And he says what becomes tyrannous is when one realm begins to dominate the others or invade them and suppress them. So, for example, we think about a plutocracy as a place where people who have money get to dominate everything else. or an aristocracy is where people who have family connections get to decide what happens in the marketplace. And it's a useful way to think about complex social systems. So an example now of a place where we have a tension like this is the entertainment industry, interested in controlling how knowledge circulates on college campuses. Now, clearly they have an interest in students downloading music that they don't own, and that's appropriate. But what they would like to do is to get into the college campuses and control the way the computer networks work. And that begins to invade a different economy and a different set of knowledge norms, because colleges and universities are more set up on a gift exchange basis in which ideas and data travel freely in a community of scholars.
Explain how this would work. How are they trying to control computer networks on college campuses?
You know, I reproduce a letter from the guy who's in charge of the computers at MIT, and what the industry would like to do is have Congress force MIT and other colleges to put filters on the networks, which would try to figure out who's sending what. And the MIT tech person says, essentially, you know, you can't put filters on our networks and still have us do the kind of science that we currently do. So filtering the college computer network would be one way of trying to impose an entertainment industry sense of the rules on a academic community's different sense of the rules.
Hmm. But this is a real tension, because on the one hand, you certainly can see the frustration of professors who want to, let's say, copy a chapter from a book so they can teach it in a class, and, you know, without having to go through all the permissions to be able to do that, without having to pay for it, because, you know, they're constantly doing this, bringing in material to their classes. And yet, on the other hand, you can see why the people who actually wrote those chapters want to get paid for their work.
Yeah, absolutely. And my book is not an anti-copyright book. I think copyright is a very useful tool. My book itself is copyrighted. I get a piece of my income from royalties. The question is, well, you say it's a tension. That's right. The question is how to find the balance. To take the example you just gave, one way that in this country that we've tried to adjudicate the balance in college campuses is, on the one hand, we have copyright, people own their work. On the other hand, we have what's called the Fair Use Statute, which allows people to use copyrighted work without asking permission, without paying fees. Fair use is supposed to square the monopoly control of copyright with the First Amendment, which allows us to speak freely. And so you and I can quote something from a book on this radio show because we have the Fair Use Statute. We don't need to get permission. The Fair Use Statute actually singles out education as a special case. It says that professors can make multiple copies for classroom use of something. There are a bunch of different carve-outs for educational use that make it easy to teach and not burden the students with monetary impediments to their own learning.
And my sense is that you really don't want to reduce this to a legal case. I mean, you're not a lawyer yourself. You obviously are familiar with the law, but you're talking about something at a larger cultural level, a societal level.
The project of my book is to try to enlarge the set of narratives that will help us think through the puzzle of cultural ownership given digital copying and the internet and so forth. And I think the entertainment industry story is a useful one to have and makes sense in some situations. But when you look at the founders, you find at least three other stories. You're right. My agenda here is more philosophical than practical. The practical would come out of getting the philosophy right. And philosophically, the three other stories are, one is about democracy, one is about creative communities, and the other one is about public personhood. How do you become an actor politically or culturally, you know, who operates in a social system as opposed to in a private individualist way?
Lewis Hyde is the author of Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Aram Sinreich teaches journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. He's also the author of Mashed Up, Music, Technology, and the Rise of Configurable Culture. Sinreich told Ann Strangchamps what he means by configurable culture.
If you look at the recent developments over the last century in material sciences, we have finally gotten to the point where we understand that matter is comprised of molecules, and the molecules are comprised of atoms, and the atoms are comprised of subatomic particles. And we have the technology to basically create a molecule from scratch, taking the component atoms, jamming them together. And that's how where new pharmaceuticals come from. We're beginning to do the same thing with genetics. Mm-hmm. We understand that GATC are the fundamental building blocks of life, and we're beginning to sequence actual organisms from scratch. We're doing this exactly the same thing with culture. Because we now have the tools to cut culture down into these component parts that are essentially atomic in nature and then configure them in our own image, we have an expressive power that is unrivaled by any society in history. And the social effects of that, of giving people that kind of fundamental power to reconfigure their environments, have yet to be felt.
Well, it makes sense then that a lot of the debates that come up around remix culture or mashups in particular, a lot of the debates center on who's the artist. Well, for instance, you interviewed a lot of DJs, attorneys, music industry executives. What did they tell you when you asked them about who's the creator of a mashup?
That's a great question. If you think about it, the concept of artist is not a necessary concept. There have been plenty of forms of expression throughout society, throughout the years, that didn't require that idea. I'm not just talking about ancient history. There's a very great example in America in the 20th century, which is a small rural society down south called G's Bend, where several generations of women collectively created a new quilting aesthetic that more or less changed the entire game. They did it without any financial incentive, and most importantly, they did it without the concept that any single one of them was an artist or the author or deserved the quote credit, unquote, for their work. It was simply a collective expression of their cultural group. Now, when you look at mashup artists who are really essentially doing the same thing, they're all drawing on the same pool of popular music being dumped into our media ecology through the radio, through television. They're all chopping it up into bits and pieces and putting it together in ways that they think are interesting or funny or politically poignant. The same lack of necessity for the concept of artist begins to appear. You don't really need to be the one to stand up and say, I am responsible for this, because in the form of the music itself is the expression not of the individual but of the group at large. Another way to say it is that the very point of the music is that no single individual can take credit for cultural expression because it springs up from the interactions between us and not from the inward places of our individual souls.
Well, somebody's name has to be on the record jacket or the CD cover. So what do the DJs say? Do they think of themselves as the authors, the artists of a particular mashup?
Well, I'd like to address your question first, the way that you posed it, which is, yes, somebody's name needs to be on the record jacket because the record jacket is the marketing for the music. And the marketing needs to conform to our economic system, which is based on the notion of sole creators and of rewarding individuals. And our entire copyright system, as well as our economic system, is really based on that premise that there are individuals whose work needs to be incentivized through remuneration, and therefore we need to give them credit and give them money for it. But when you ask the DJs themselves, are you an artist? They don't say yes, but they don't say no. They definitely want credit for participating in the project, but very few of them will claim that what they're producing is solely their own work and is purely self-expression rather than communitarian expression. So what you get are these amazing kinds of pretzel logic coming out of their mouths where they say, you know, I spoke to one DJ named DJ Axel. By night, he's a very popular mashup DJ in California, and by day, he's actually a major label record executive. He works in licensing. And so he's a deeply conflicted individual. And when I asked him, what are you? Are you an artist? Are you a fan? He stammered and came up with just a laundry list of titles. He said, well, I'm not a composer, but I guess I'm a producer, but I'm really an arranger, and it's kind of like I'm an engineer. And then at the end, he said, to heck with it all, only he used more profane language. He said, I'm all of that. And it was actually this beautiful moment in my interview where I got to see him for the first time really address that conflict that he had and embrace the totality of what being a mashup DJ is.
Hmm. You've actually come up with a term. You suggest that we're seeing the emergence of DJ consciousness. What is that?
Well, I'm borrowing the formation from W.E.B. Du Bois, the great social theorist of a century ago, who described the Black American experience as being double consciousness. And what he meant by that was, to be Black in America is always to be seeing yourself simultaneously as subject and as object, from within as an actor, and from without, reflected in the eyes of those around you who are judging you or who see you as a foreign interloper in their midst. And double consciousness has not only been a weakness, it's also been a strength of the African-American experience. The entire history of African-American culture is based on creating products and expressive forms that mean one thing on one level to outsiders and another thing on a second level to insiders. If you look at the way in which DJs structure their work, exactly the same thing is true. They're always hearing themselves both from the inside and from the outside. They're both an artist and a fan. They're both a producer and a consumer. They are both the originator of the work and the conduit through which the work is distributed. And this DJ consciousness, this ability to see themselves from within and without, is really becoming a mainstream form of consciousness, of epistemology in America, because more and more and more of us are engaging in activities that are akin to what DJs do.
Sure. I mean, think about Facebook or crowdsourcing or wikis. I mean, you don't have to be making music to be very familiar with being in that role of both being both the consumer and the creator of something at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly my point. And I've actually fielded surveys. I'm about to field another one that show that, you know, if you look at individual forms of configurable culture, let's say making a mashup or modifying a video game or creating machinima, which is when you take video game characters and you make a movie out of them, each of those forms might only have, you know, 2%, 5%, 10% of the population engaged in them. But when you add it all up, the majority of us, all Americans, are engaged in some form of configurable culture, which means that each of us, to some degree, is adopting DJ consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, what does it mean that the form of consciousness and the strategies that adhered to, you know, our most oppressed subculture and ethnic group throughout our country's history are now being adopted by the mainstream? You know, I think the political ramifications are staggering.
There are still battles over music copyright law, though, aren't there?
Absolutely. Copyright is lagging very far behind the kinds of cultural forms that we're creating for ourselves as a society. And you can understand the battles over copyright as very small turf wars in this larger battle over what our society is going to look like as our culture becomes configurable and as our technologies become networked and digital and faster and global. You can see this double standard in some of the court rulings over copyright. For instance, there was a very famous suit in which the Beastie Boys, the hip-hop group, sampled about 5 or 6 seconds of a song by the flute player James Newton.
And you can feel what I'm feeling, and it's a musical masterpiece. Hear what I'm dealing with, and that's cool at least. What's running through my mind comes through in my walk. Two feelings are shown from the way that I talk. And this is me, y'all.
There are two copyrights for music. One is for the composition itself, and the other is for the actual sound of the recording. And they had licensed the sound of the recording, but they had not licensed the composition. And the judge found that what they had taken was small enough and transformed enough that it was okay. They successfully defended themselves against the accusation of plagiarizing or using without permission the composition. On the other hand, there was the hip-hop group N.W.A., which took 2 seconds of a guitar solo from a Parliament Funkadelic song.
2 seconds?
And 2 seconds. And they put it backwards and through all kinds of filters. And you never would have recognized it in the finished product. It was much less recognizable than the Beastie Boys.
They have to take our head for what we said in the past. Point blank, they can kiss my black ass.
But because they had not cleared the rights for the recording itself, the judge found that they were in violation of copyright and they had actually stolen the music and were liable for it. And this double standard, this notion that if you take a piece of the composition, well, that's okay because it's a small enough unit that you can transform it. But if you take a piece of the recorded music, that's not okay because there's no such thing as a de minimis. There's no such thing as a small enough unit. Well, you can view that as a political statement by the judge, a political statement that this new process of chopping culture into its constituent parts, its atoms, is fundamentally in violation with the philosophy of Western society as we know it and must be stopped by any means, and that there is absolutely no minimum threshold that you can reach that is not stealing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a statement that goes far beyond the scope of copyright law and is really a statement of political philosophy.
Let's play it out the other way. What would our society look like? How would it be organized if the premises that underlie configurable culture were to become mainstream?
Well, there are a number of principles that I pull out in my book that I think point the way towards what that society would look like. One of them you've already mentioned, which is this DJ consciousness. There are others, however, like the inversion or the collision of public and private, the notion that we have this kind of sphere around us and everything that happens in that sphere is ours and everything that happens outside of it belongs to society at large. That's collapsing very, very rapidly. You can see that both in the music and in the absolute willingness of young people to share every gory detail of their lives on Facebook. There's another idea. One of Marx's great critiques about our economy was that there was what he called the alienation of labor, which is that people no longer have a relationship to the things that they build. If you make shoes for somebody, you have touched their feet, you have made sure that the leather and the sole perfectly mold to their arch. If you work in a shoe factory, however, you're just pulling a lever over and over again that chops a piece of, you know, identically cut leather from a big strip. What I've found is that these new musical premises, the new guiding rules of configurable culture, suggest that there's going to be a reunion of labor, that people are going to become much more self-contained and autonomous workers in any field, not just in music or even in culture at large. And I think we see a real shift towards this in the move towards DIY culture, towards craft culture, and the explosion of new magazines and television shows and overall interest in making things for yourself and for your friends and family.
And yet, is there a single piece of remixed, mashed up, sampled music that can stand up to the best produced by Beethoven or the Beatles or Miles Davis?
Well, you're presupposing that there's some objective measure of bestness there. And let me say, I'm a giant Miles Davis fan. I mean, I'll never get tired of listening to his late 60s quintet. But absolutely, I think, you know, let's talk about this year. The most interesting song I've heard all year was the Bed Intruder song created by the Gregory Brothers, distributed through YouTube and iTunes, where they took a news story about a home invader somewhere down south and I think it was in Huntsville, Alabama, or something like that. And the brother of the victim who spoke on local news television, they took his voice and they auto-tuned it and made it into an R&B song. And that R&B song, within weeks, had been covered by thousands and thousands of other people in every imaginable genre around the world. Now, who's the author of that? Is it the man who was interviewed on the TV news station? Is it the brothers who remixed his voice to make it into a song? Is it the people who covered the song and turned it into a global meme, a phenomenon? Well, in reality, it's all of them. It's something that emerged from the kinds of connections that we've built for ourselves. And by the way, it was amazingly catchy.
He's climbing in your windows, he's snatching your people up, trying to rape them, so you need to hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your wife, and hide your husband, because they're raping everybody out here. You don't have to come and confess, we're looking for you, we gon' find you, we gon' find you, so you can run and tell that, run and tell that, run and tell that, homeboy, home, home, homeboy. I tell them we don't run around crying and acting sad. We just dust our shoulders off and keep on moving.
Aram Sinreich is the author of Mashed Up, Music, Technology, and the Rise of Configurable Culture. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. What do you think about Aram Sinreich's and Lewis Hyde's thoughts about ideas and creativity? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, Stephen Johnson on the natural history of innovation as we continue our hour on the cultural commons. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Stephen Johnson's the author of such bestsellers as The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Mind Wide Open. His new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Johnson opens the book with a description of Charles Darwin's 1836 visit to the coral reef off the Keeling Islands. Coral reefs recur throughout the book. Stephen Johnson explains the connection he sees between the coral reef and innovation.
The thing that is so interesting about the coral reef is that it is capable of creating all this amazing kind of biodiversity. I mean, it accounts for this extraordinary amount of something like 25% of the species of marine life are in coral reefs, even though they're a small fraction of 1% of the surface of the planet. So they themselves, in biological terms, are great innovators, right? They create a space where all these different kind of livelihoods can be pursued by all these different organisms. And there's a kind of a riddle there, which is the waters of the coral reef are actually kind of nutrient poor. They shouldn't support that much life. And yet somehow there's this great thriving metropolis under the sea there. The kind of mystery there is known as Darwin's paradox, that you know, you would see so much biodiversity in such a kind of unlikely place. And so in this book, I wanted to kind of look not just at spaces where human beings have been unusually innovative, but I also wanted to look at spaces where kind of life has been unusually innovative. And so the coral reef kind of becomes the motif for that.
This is where the adjacent possible comes in, right? You've identified seven, I think, key patterns behind genuine innovation. And the first of them is the adjacent possible. Can you explain that for us?
In a sense, it's the framing pattern that explains, in general, what the other patterns are doing. It's a wonderful term from the scientist Stuart Kaufman that I first read about 10 years ago, and it's one of those ideas I've been trying to get into a book ever since I first read it. And Stuart's idea basically is that there is, at any given point in a moment in history, in a moment in kind of the evolution of life, there is the given kind of state of the system, whether it's a technology platform or a coral reef. And there are a certain number of transformations that are possible. There are certain ways in which that state can be changed. And then there's a certain huge number of ways in which it can't be changed. And it's like, imagine a chessboard. You're at a certain point in the middle of the game. There's a finite number of moves that you can make. There are a lot of them, but there's a finite number. The adjacent possible is all those potential moves that are available to you. So, you know, if you think about it this way, you can't, for instance, in the history of technology, you can't invent a microwave oven in 1600. It just is, it exceeds the bounds of the adjacent possible. And so when you're trying to think kind of an innovative way, whether it's in your organization or your personal life or, you know, in society, what you're trying to do is explore the edges of the adjacent possible, not jump too far ahead, not exceed those boundaries, but kind of knock on the doors at the edges of that space and find the new things that you're capable of changing.
You can't talk about ideas these days without talking about copyright and intellectual property. How do we find the balance between allowing a free flow of ideas that's going to lead to other great ideas and compensating the people who developed the original ideas?
Well, the word you used is the right one, balance. I'm not a kind of a free culture extremist here. I think that there is a place for intellectual property law and for copyright and patents. And indeed, one of the reasons patents were developed was that they involved an element of disclosure. You had to file your patent and expose to the rest of the world. You just were protected for a period of time, but you also had to share the idea. In a sense, this is a book that is trying to argue that the primary driver of innovation is not just the profit motive, not just the competitive pressure of kind of proprietary firms. It's not just the marketplace, but that there is a long and very rich history of world-changing ideas that came out of more open, more connective environments, whether it's kind of the Enlightenment scientists who were just doing it for the love of it, or the university system, or the open source environments, the internet and the web. And that tradition is just as powerful and maybe even more powerful than the kind of competitive marketplace. And so in a sense, the slogan for that is that, you know, it's important for ideas to connect as it is for us to try and protect them in a sense. So what's the balance? And I'll just tell you one example. There's a wonderful program by Nike. Nike has a corporate mission to be more environmentally sustainable in what it does. It's a big part of their kind of their overarching goals as an organization. They realize that they're sitting on all this interesting intellectual property, some of which is patented, in their research and development labs. You know, new rubbers for their sneakers that will be more environmentally sustainable to build, right? Now, they realize that by holding this stuff secret, they have ideas there that might actually be useful to somebody in a field that's not at all competitive to what Nike does, right? There's a tire manufacturer who could use those rubbers. Nike doesn't make tires. And so they created this thing called the Green Exchange in concert with Creative Commons, and they released all these ideas with a new kind of patent. And the patent basically says, you know, here's an easy little one-click form to take our ideas. You don't need to negotiate a contract to borrow this stuff. And the only thing is, don't use it in a field that's competitive with stuff that we do.
So don't make shoes.
Yeah, if you're making sneakers, if you're Adidas, you can't use it. But if you are of Goodyear and you're making a tire, that's fine. And there are ideas that not only will that make for, you know, help their cause of a more sustainable future, but they might learn from somebody else's appropriation of their ideas, and somebody might add something to it, and they can borrow it back. And that's a kind of balance where it's using patents, it's using intellectual property law, but it's respecting the need of these ideas to make these unlikely connections.
Another of the seven key patterns you describe in the book is serendipity. Now, serendipity sounds like an accident to me, but maybe that's a good idea. Maybe we need accidents.
Yeah, you want to have a certain level of noise in the data, right? You want to have a little bit of kind of surprising connections. I mean, for instance, one thing I talk about in the book is that I use this interesting kind of research tool, which is a piece of software called DevonThink, when I'm working on my books. And I've put into DevonThink over the years thousands of little quotes from books that I've read and articles that I've read that I found interesting.
A digital commonplace book.
Yeah, exactly. Commonplace book being the kind of old Enlightenment era kind of tradition. And DevonThink has this kind of special software trick where it can detect kind of subtle, semantic, kind of meaningful connections between small snippets of text. And so I'll write a paragraph, and then I don't do this all the time, but when I'm kind of in an improvisational mode with my ideas, I'll write a paragraph and I'll show it to DevonThink and say, show me things that are related to this. And it'll come back with all these quotes, some of them that I read, you know, 10 years ago that I've completely forgotten. I mean, I've forgotten the book that the quote is from, much less the quote. And it's noisy. It's not always right. You know, the first three are really obvious connections. The next four are really random and not at all right. But the next one, there's something brilliant there. And it's precisely because it's a little bit noisy, a little bit chaotic, that it ends up taking me down these interesting new avenues. And I've had connections suggested to me through DevonThink that have led to entire chapters of books. And the question really, and it sounds like a joke, but it's a serious question, is when those, you know, big ideas come out of that interaction, who's really having the idea? You know, is it me or is it the software, right? And I think on some level you have to say it's a little bit of both. It's a kind of duet between two very different kinds of intelligence.
Well, it is a lot like the commonplace book used to be, except that it adds that ability to remember things that's hard for humans.
Yeah. I mean, what's important about the commonplace book tradition, and I think this is something we can still do, you know, people like Jefferson and Franklin and Locke, they would keep these books where they would write down all these quotes. But a big thing that they would do is they would go back and they would reread their commonplace book. And in a sense, their intellectual kind of sense of self, their perspectives on the world, would come out of revisiting all these quotes that they'd taken from other sources and some of their own notes in between them. And it was by remixing all these different ideas and synthesizing them and revisiting them that slowly over time they would kind of forge their own identity and their own ideas. And that's something we can still do. You don't even need a very complex semantic search algorithm to do that. You can just write down your notes and quote things and just revisit those ideas.
Tell me about fourth quadrant systems. We're in the fourth quarter of the game here. Is that what you're thinking about, fourth quadrant systems?
Well, the problem with writing a book where you're making an argument about how culture works is that the easiest way to do it, although it's not terribly easy, but what I do for most of the book is there's just a lot of stories or a lot of anecdotes, you know, 30, 40, 50 different stories from different fields. And you try and convince people that the point you're making is true and that these anecdotes represent the truth about society. But people are always going to accuse you of kind of cherry-picking and not telling these other stories that make the other point. And so in the last chapter, to kind of combat or anticipate that criticism, I kind of zoomed out and looked at 300, you know, big innovations in science and in technology over that last 600 years and just tried to figure out how many of them came from kind of individual entrepreneurs working with the profit motive, how many came from corporations kind of competing with each other, how many of them came from just amateur individuals, and how many of them came from kind of networked open source environments or university environments where there's a lot of collaboration and sharing of ideas and so on. And that's the fourth quadrant. And I kind of map them onto this grid. And the fourth quadrant is that open space. And it turns out even in the modern age, even after the development of kind of modern industrial and consumer capitalism, while the marketplace does generate a lot of important things and there's a great explosion in activity there, the fourth quadrant is even bigger. There's more innovation that comes out of that space. And it's precisely because the connective power of that environment, the freedom of ideas to kind of move and be refined and be accepted, is stronger than the kind of incentivizing, you know, force of financial reward. Mm-hmm. And so it's hopefully making the argument not that those two – oftentimes what you find is that the fourth quadrant creates a platform that commercial, you know, entities can then build upon. I mean, think about the web. Think about how many immense fortunes have been made on top of this very open platform. So they're not at odds with each other. They actually can collaborate in lots of ways as well.
So you actually ask the question whether it's possible to harness that. It's a more involved question the way you put it. But that's interesting. And it leads me to wonder whether, in fact, if you can harvest the fourth quadrant systems, does another quadrant develop because you have to have one that's outside of your harness?
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's possible that we've created these new ways of collaborating, that there are these new models, whether it's the web or Wikipedia, that are going to become the new normal. And someone is going to figure out this, you know, this extra space out there that can, you know, how do you innovate on top of an open innovative platform like Wikipedia? But those people, I think, are smarter than I am. So I don't have that in my head. Yeah,
even after all of this, clearly you've thought a lot about this. And I'm assuming this has changed the way you approach your work.
Well, the fun thing is that the book itself is an example of the kind of thinking that I'm arguing for. I mean, it is a very connective book, and my methods in putting these stories together, and in a sense trying to, in reading it, hopefully the reader gets to go through all these different fields and stories, and, you know, from biology to technology, from the very old technology to the very recent. And through all those jumps, you know, there will be interesting collisions and surprising connections, and there certainly were for me when I was writing it.
Stephen Johnson's the author of Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Where do your good ideas come from? You can let us know by sending email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, remixing the great American novel Moby Dick as we conclude our Hour on the Cultural Commons. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Ricardo Pitts-Wiley is the co-founder of the Mixed Magic Theater Company. He's also a contributor to an essay by Henry Jenkins in a book called Mashup Cultures. The essay is called Multiculturalism, Appropriation, and the New Media Literacies, Remixing Moby Dick. It focuses on Pitts-Wiley's contemporary restaging of Herman Melville's classic novel Moby Dick. The production is called Moby Dick Then and Now. Ricardo Pitts-Wiley told Anne Strangehams that the play emerged from the work he did with incarcerated youth through the Rhode Island training facility.
And I was the one who chose Moby Dick as the project. And as a matter of fact, there was quite a bit of questions when I suggested it, because I had an idea going into the program that I could relate the Moby Dick story to the drug trade. And there was a lot of concern about that going in. But I believed in the idea. And once I got in there with the students, they not only confirmed what I believed about the power of the novel and its flexibility and pliability, but they also freed me and my imagination to explore the novel at a much deeper level than I had originally thought I'd be able to do.
How does Moby Dick relate to the international drug trade?
Well, if you look at the basis of the novel, Ahab was in the business of killing whales. He wasn't a casual bystander in this business. So when he was attacked by the whale was in his turf, in his territory. And, you know, he wasn't on, you know, Ahab wasn't on the QE2 on vacation. He was trying to kill whales. It's ultimately about the money, what we are willing to do for the money. You venture into this world where you're after something that's so big and so powerful that you really don't always understand how big or powerful it is.
Are you saying that instead of a novel about the great white whale, you can see it as a novel about the great white blow?
Most definitely. In fact, in my production, we call what the young people are dealing with white thing. Part of what I had to do in constructing my play was the crew, the gang, if you will. I call them the crew of young people who pursue their white whale, which is called white thing, the drug lord. They've been wounded by this thing also.
So how did these young incarcerated men respond when you first pitched the idea of working with Moby Dick to them?
They embraced it much easier and quicker than I thought they would.
Had any of them even read Moby Dick?
Most of them read it. And if they hadn't read it when we started, by the time we ended, they had all read it. And they became very invested in the work. Because one of the things that I had asked them to do was take a character out of Moby Dick and rethink it the way in your life and time. Think about a character as you would create that character. And that probably was the most significant part of the experience, because for as much as I had an idea about how I could tell this story in a modern context, they took it further than I would have originally.
What kind of stories did they come up with?
I'll use the young man who chose Queequeg as his character. He said, well, Queequeg is a pimp. A pimp? Well, you know, when you first meet him, he's dealing in human flesh. He's selling shrunken heads in New Bedford. He's exotic. He's beautiful. He's dangerous. He's intensely loyal. And he is a person you would want as a friend and do not want as an enemy. Another young man wrote about Ahab, and he said, well, you know, Ahab's in the business. He was the number one drug dealer for White Thing. And White Thing saw him getting powerful. So White Thing sent agents to destroy him, and instead they got his wife, who was pregnant with a child. And his revenge is based on that. You hurt not just me. You meant to get me, but you hurt the thing that was closest to me. He humanized Ahab. You know, Ahab in the novel has a wife and a son.
Now, I imagine these are young people. Remix culture is part of their world, part of their life. So they're probably really comfortable with this approach. But there must have been older people in the prison system or people who came and watched the play who wouldn't be so comfortable with remixing a classic.
Well, in the beginning, I got quite a bit of resistance from the established community, if you will. Not the academic community, though, which I was surprised. This project was followed very closely by the New Media Literacies Program at MIT. And the conference that we planned around our production of Moby Dick with their assistance, we brought in scholars from all over the country. And they were the ones who were the most supportive of saying, this is a great novel. We've got to find a way to get young people invested in this great novel. And this is a way of doing it. You know, in remixing, and this is one of the things I talk about a lot when I talk about not just remixing and appropriation and Moby Dick and Frankenstein and on and on and on. You have to trust the original text. You have to respect the original text. And you have to understand the source of where you're getting things from. And then when you remix, you don't change the original. What you do is find a way for you to access the original. That's what we did in our production.
So when you do something like this, what's the difference between ripping off Melville and remixing Melville?
When you talk about ripping off Melville, what a term. First of all, you should rip off Melville and Shakespeare and Ibsen and Shaw and Baldwin and all of them. They should be ripped off. You should go and grab what they've got to offer and take it and run with it and learn from it. But in the process, if literature is good, there's almost nothing you can do to destroy it. When we're in a process of remixing or doing an adaptation, page-to-stage adaptation, I tell myself and the people I'm working with, we're going to test this thing to the breaking point. We're going to find every way we can for this thing to fall apart. Because when you start to layer remixing and appropriation over it, if the original material is good and solid, it keeps giving no matter how much stress you put on it. And drama demands that you push it to the limit. Push it until it breaks. Well, you know, Melville never broke. No matter what layer we put on top of it, Melville just kept giving.
Ricardo Pitts-Wiley is the writer and director of the theatrical production Moby Dick, Then and Now. Here's a short excerpt from the play.
Now we young and thuggish, well organized and well strapped. We make our way dealing. We making up cake to live like we want to live for as long as we can. We're not forced to flip burgers or work like slaves for somebody else and still live from paycheck to paycheck.
Who ain't a slave?
We try not to get too close to anything but the hood, which we love. We try not to get too close to anybody but each other, which is all we have most of the time. Everything was cool until Pip, the cool leader's little brother, decided to take some of our product and sell it himself to show Alba, his big sister, that he belonged. But he didn't belong. But white things, the drug lords, he didn't know that. And he didn't care.
That's an excerpt from Mixed Magic Theater's production of Moby Dick, Then and Now. For more information about upcoming productions, you can find a link to Mixed Magic Theater's website on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1024A, Cultural Commons. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.